This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome, welcome to the House of EcoShock. Last week we tried a little shock therapy, a modest proposal from Dr. Jack Alpert to sterilize everyone to bring about rapid population decline. Birth permits, just 350,000 of them a year, would be awarded to the lucky few by lottery. Earth would head back down to the 100 million human animals it can support forever. For now, that's just dark science fiction. But the reality of overpopulation and overconsumption is not. Right now, the Egyptian people are celebrating just the possibility they might escape the tortuous grasp of the Pharaoh Mubarak. But there are no happy days coming for anyone in the Middle East. The number of people in most countries there has doubled since 1980, but the land base hasn't. About a third of the population is under the age of 24. Half of all adults are unemployed. Humans have outgrown the land base, and the food must be imported. Always. There is no possible political solution for anyone, no matter how well intended. We can say the same for Mexico in its drug wars, for India, for much of the world. As the fossil fuel runs out, gets crazy expensive, and wrecks the climate, we'll find out Earth cannot support 7 billion humans for long. And we are still expanding by 217,000 humans a day. It's time to drag this out of the closet. This week on Radio EcoShock, we'll take another crack at it as part of the month of February, Population Speak Out. You can find one of the front lines, not in some faraway slum, but right where you live. Every child born in high-consumption countries in places like North America, Europe, or Australia consumes and pollutes hundreds of times more than a baby born in the poorest agrarian countries. We suck it all up and we throw it all away. Our governments and our deepest social and biological roots continue to push for even more fossil-fueled kids. It's a homegrown Ponzi scheme built right out of human lives and soon endless human suffering. Can we change all that? Can we head back down the mountain towards sustainability, making our numbers match the true natural production of the land where we live? In this program, you will hear three voices with solutions, not drastic voices, but human ones with real choices. We'll kick off with Lisa Hymas, co-founder and senior editor of the most successful online green magazine on the planet, Grist.org. She'll tell us about Ginks, green inclined, no kids. Following Lisa, clinical psychologist Dr. Ellen L. Walker will talk about the good and the bad of going child-free. Can we be complete without kids? And don't miss our third interview. The granddaddy of the whole population movement, Dr. Paul Ehrlich, joins us. His 1968 book, The Population Bomb, woke us up. Now he's got a surprising new tool that could help us survive the multiple crises we face. Right now on Radio EcoShock. In a Wim Wenders film, a tender young woman has a dour philosopher friend. When she goes to him brightly to announce her pregnancy, the philosopher reacts in horror, and he says something like, How could you bring a child into this troubled world? As the economy and fossil fuels and climate change worry us all, more young people are asking themselves this question. Maybe they will become ginks. To explain that, we have Lisa Hymas, the Seattle-based co-founder and senior editor of Grist, the progressive online magazine. Lisa, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Nice to be here.
Well, please tell us, what is a GINK?
Sure. GINK is an acronym that I came up with to describe myself. It stands for Green Inclinations, No Kids. And I just wanted to get people talking about the choice to be child-free. There's still a strong assumption in our society that all of us will or should become parents. And, you know, considering the environmental impact that each additional person, particularly each additional North American, brings, I think it's worth talking about whether we should all be having kids.
And about a year ago, you published the Gink Manifesto. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, I did. It was kind of my way of coming out and saying that I'm child-free and that, you know, explaining my reasons. And certainly the environment was part of my thinking, but not the only reason. I have a busy career, a busy life. I'm happy with things as they are, and I don't feel the need to have kids. So in my case, not having children was actually an easy thing that I could do to help the environment. You know, I think often making the green choice can feel like a sacrifice or a hassle or an expense. In this case, for me, it feels like a really nice, positive choice for myself that also happens to be good for the planet.
Well, let me get a stupid question out of the way. Do you have something against parents or cute little kids?
No, and thank you for asking, because I want to make that clear, that I definitely think that for a lot of people, being parents is the right choice, and I totally respect that. You know, my own friends and family members who have kids, I'm excited for them. I'm happy to be involved in their kids' lives. I love to dote on my nieces and nephew. I just want, the same way that society supports parents, I just want them to support the child-free as well.
I suppose we do have to get past that Victorian label of the spinster. Nobody wanted it. They were told they would be useless and alone, and we don't say spinster anymore, but are there new labels, and where are the social pressures on women to get busy reproducing?
Well, you know, there are a lot of pressures. I think a lot of it comes from our families and friends. As soon as we start getting a little bit older, it's like, when are you going to get married, and then when are you going to have a kid, and then when are you going to have the next kid? But there's also a lot of pressure in popular culture. You know, if you read the celebrity tabloid magazines, they're always showing pregnant celebrities looking glamorous and their kids looking stylish. And, you know, there's sort of a cult of fashionable motherhood. But I've been seeing some trends this past year pointing in the other direction. We have a few celebrities and people coming out and saying, you know, I've decided not to have kids, and that's the right choice for me. And a couple of them have even mentioned the environment as a reason for that. The actress Cameron Diaz and the actor Vincent Kartheiser, who's on Mad Men. So, and, you know, Oprah is probably the most famous child-free person out there. She's certainly an influential voice. So I think we're sort of starting in the culture to ask the question or create a little bit more space for people who do things differently.
How does not having a child compare with other carbon reduction schemes? Is it fair to ask that question?
Sure, it's a fair question. I mean, I'll say right at the front that I don't think anybody's worth is measured by their carbon impact. So, you know, that doesn't mean that parents who have kids are doing a bad thing. But, you know, there is an environmental effect. So there was a study done in 2009 by some statisticians at Oregon State University, and they concluded that for each child that an American has, it will increase their lifetime emissions by about 5.7 times, or 570%. That's basically because you have a kid and they're going to grow up and be like you and consume energy and, you know, consume products, and then they'll probably have kids of their own. So the repercussions do go through the generations. And these same researchers also, you know, they put it that, you know, choosing not to have a child is about 20 times more effective than some of the other things that you might do in your life to save energy. So whether that's like driving a more eco-friendly car like a Prius, or changing out your light bulbs, or switching your diet to be lower impact.
Well, you've just made a man named Jack Alpert very happy. He's an engineer who is saying that we can never under-consume our way out of this crisis, that really population is the key, and we've just got to cut back our population. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think we need to consider both sides of the equation. I mean, you know, environmental impact is, in a sense, the number of people times their level of consumption. I think we need to work on both of those figures. Now, in North America, North American uses far more energy and resources than someone in a developing country. So we have a much bigger impact, and it's incumbent on us more to reduce our consumption. So the average American has a carbon footprint that's about 200 times bigger than the average Ethiopian. So consumption certainly plays a role in it, for sure.
Well, beyond the environment or population, you've talked about real benefits of staying child-free. Could you talk about that?
Sure. Well, one of the interesting things that I've found as I've been talking to and hearing from other people is that a lot of child-free people actually work with kids and find that they have the energy to bring to their jobs because they don't have kids at home. So that includes a lot of school teachers, people who work in at-risk youth programs. I have one friend actually who works in hospice with children who are dying. That's a really intense job, and she's doing something really important, but she feels like she wouldn't have the energy and sort of the mental stability to do that if she had kids of her own. So I think that people who are child-free can find a lot of other ways to give back to society. I mean, on a self-focused level, you might have more time to put into your career or your personal relationships or your hobbies or just relaxing, even just sleeping. You know, being a parent, as any parent will tell you, is a very intensive endeavor, and I totally respect parents for taking that on. But I just want to encourage everybody to think before they have kids so that children are a choice or a decision and not an assumption.
Right. I think we need room for perhaps a new class of woman, but I think there's also a question in the back of people's minds. They say to themselves, can a woman be complete without experiencing birth and child raising?
Right. I mean, and there are some people who say you can't. I guess I would strongly disagree with that. We all lead different paths in life. We experience some things and we don't experience others. And I feel like by choosing this path for myself, yes, I am going to be missing out on some things. I'm missing out on a lot of the experiences that parents have, but I will get to experience other things, whether that's spending time, writing for myself or reading or traveling or maybe nurturing the relationships in my own life. And, you know, this is something, what I've been interested to find out as people have been communicating with me is a lot of men connect with this too. I mean, these days, you know, a number of decades ago, men weren't that involved in child rearing necessarily. These days they are. So men need to think hard about this too, about whether they feel like they have the energy and the desire to be a good involved dad before they go down that path.
And there's kind of a double standard in the media. I noticed the criticism of Supreme Court Associate Justice Alina Kagan, and you've written about this.
Yes.
And it seems sort of like almost a veiled attempt to maintain male dominance by making sure that career-oriented women feel guilty or should get rerouted through these family duties.
Yeah, I feel like there are a lot of unfair expectations placed on women, and it's sort of, if you're not a mother like Alina Kagan, you could get criticized as not being, you know, not having empathy, not really knowing what it's like. But then again, if you are a mother, you can be criticized for not paying enough attention to your kids while you're out in the workforce. So, you know, I want to help us bust through all of that and accept women's choices, whatever they are.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is senior editor at Grist Magazine, Lisa Hymas, and we're talking about Ginks, Green Inclined, No Kids. Lisa Hymas, you are certainly not alone. According to the Pew Research Center, about 10% of older women didn't have kids in the 1970s, and that has doubled to nearly 20% of child-free women now. So I guess what is missing is that voice that you're attempting to provide, like, let's come out of the reproductive closet and assert a new class of womanhood. Would you agree?
Right. That's definitely what I want to do. Those are some pretty impressive statistics that I think might surprise a lot of people, that maybe 1 out of 5 women won't end up having a child. That's a lot of us, but it's still something that we don't talk about that much out in the culture. So that is what I'm trying to do, just get us to talk about it, let women or, you know, women or men know that they're not alone when they make this choice. I've heard from a lot of people who said, thank you so much for writing about this, for talking about this. I have felt really alone, and it's great to know that I'm not the only one.
And it's strange, you know, after the supposed liberation that happened in the 70s, that here we are in 2010 saying, well, it's okay not to have kids. How did we get there?
I don't know. It's sort of, yeah, it is ridiculous that it's been this long, but we still have these expectations. I think, you know, they're just built into the culture, and they're hard to get rid of. You know, I like to think that we're gradually changing minds and getting there, but I think it's still going to be a little while before being child-free is as normal as being a parent.
Are you having fun with the gink thing? Or are people connecting with it?
Oh, yeah. I've definitely had a lot of fun with it. I've had a lot of responses from people, and I've had some positive, well, positive and negative responses from parents, but some of them have been positive. They said, you know, I thought about these things before I had a kid. I totally understand where you're coming from. A few months ago, one woman who also writes for Grist sometimes, she recently had a baby and contacted me and said, hey, let's write a piece together about how ginks and parents can get along, how we can all support each other in our decisions. So we wrote up a sort of a fun little piece about what to say or what not to say to folks in the other camp, sort of facilitate conversation and open this up.
And where do you see this going?
I guess I just hope that more and more of us will be talking about it. And I think this is a great year to do it because the world population is poised to hit 7 billion this fall. That's a lot of people. And it's about time we started talking more about the impact of population growth.
Well, you raise a really serious point, and I think it's how can activist women help beyond not having a child? How can we help stop this tide of overpopulation that threatens our happiness and our planet? Do you have some suggestions on that?
Sure. You know, one of the biggest things, I definitely don't support any coercive policies or anything like China's one-child policy. We don't need that. I mean, the first and most important thing we need to do is make sure that all women everywhere have access to contraception and to family planning services. There are an estimated 200 million women around the world who don't have that yet, you know, in a lot of poor countries. So, you know, the U.S. government funds some of those programs. International bodies fund them. There's some nonprofits and NGOs that work on that. I think we need to support all of those efforts. That's definitely key. And part of it is also not only giving women contraception, but making sure that they're empowered in their own communities, in their families, that they have education, that they have economic opportunities, all of those things. You know, most women, when they have options, would rather have smaller families and be able to contribute some to the economic health of their families. So that's sort of the big picture answer. On a more micro level, but that's not something that, you know, you or I can solve overnight. But one thing I did recently was write a post called 8 Things You Can Do About Population. And it was sort of looking at some of the things that we can all do in our own lives. Let's see, one of those things I mentioned was, you know, if you're a parent, don't pressure other people to have kids. You know, just let them make their own decisions. I suggested that we need to improve sex education in our schools, at least certainly in America. A lot of those programs, if they have them at all, are really terrible. And I think we could all agree that it would be better to have a lower teen birth rate. So the U.S. right now, even though the teen birth rate has fallen in the last couple of years, it's still higher than in a lot of other developed countries, particularly Europe. And I think we'd all be better off if our teenagers were better prepared, better informed about how to protect themselves.
Well, how can people find your articles?
Sure. Well, on grist.org, GRIST.org, you can search on population or search on child-free or search on my name, Lisa Hymas, and they should come right up.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and I'm honored to have as our guest one of the pioneers of online journalism, Grist Senior Editor Lisa Hymas. Lisa, it's been fun, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You're having my baby. You're a woman in love, and I love what's going through you. The need inside you, I see it showing. Oh, the seed inside you, baby.
Deciding not to have kids can be an emotional and social minefield, and what if you don't decide, but you just can't? Thanks to contraception, people today have more choices than any previous human generation, but not many tools or examples to follow. Here to guide us is Dr. Ellen L. Walker. She's a clinical psychologist, self-proclaimed child-free person, and author of a really helpful and rare new book, Complete Without Kids, An Insider's Guide to Child-Free Living by Choice or by Chance. Ellen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
First, the obvious question, why child-free instead of childless?
I felt really strongly about using the word child-free when I began to write my book because I think this is a topic that has so much negative stigma against those of us who aren't parents that I wanted us to all feel really good about our decision and not as if we were missing something.
Well, certainly to say childless already has the word less in it, and we don't need that. Well, you've not been a professional author until now. Why did you decide to write this book?
I decided to write the book because I was having my own personal struggles with the fact that I was over 40 and hadn't had kids and never really thought about it very much, but all of a sudden I started having these, oh no, what if I made a big mistake thoughts that just kept coming into my mind. And I realized that if I, who I'm a psychologist and feel like I have really good insight, if I was having these struggles, that other people must be also. So I just started talking to people about their own experiences, and I found that they wanted to share and talk.
As you say, people without kids are not all the same. They arrive by three different routes. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Now, probably the most common way that people end up being child-free is kind of by accident. And ironically, that's the most common way that most people end up being parents also. Over 50% of pregnancies in the United States are not planned. And so I think most of us who don't have kids, we might have become parents had we married a certain kind of person or had we gotten pregnant or had, you know, just had life turned out differently. So that's most of us. Then there are some women in particular, and men as well, who say that they never wanted to have kids, and they've known this since they were teenagers. And that's a small group of child-free adults. And then, of course, there are people who desperately wanted to become parents and just couldn't make it happen. Either they couldn't get pregnant or they never found a partner that was the right person to have a child with and they didn't feel comfortable being a single on their own parent. So that's the third group. And those folks tend to want to identify themselves as childless.
Early in the book, though, you hit the target with that simple question women are asked all the time, do you have kids? And what happens if the answer is no?
I find that there's kind of a silence whenever I say I don't have kids. People don't really know what to say after that. I have to kind of take the ball and change the subject or turn it over to their own children. Somehow it seems like it's our responsibility to try to make everybody feel okay then.
Well, Dr. Walker, part of my radio focus this week is overpopulation on this small planet. And I'm thinking, what if we reversed that situation? What if people were embarrassed to have kids and had to explain why they did?
That would be pretty funny. I think that would really be amazing and wonderful. And, you know, I'm not sure that the idea of them having to explain why they had children, but to be able to, before they get pregnant, to be able to demonstrate to themselves and to others that they're ready to take on the responsibility, they've got the financial means, they've got the emotional energy, they've got the willingness to make a lifelong commitment no matter how their child turns out. I think that would be a great place for us to be in our society.
And I was interested in your look at media pressure to have children. Let's talk about what we see on the screen. What are the messages?
The message is quite clear. You fall in love, you get married, and you have a baby within a year. That is the message in almost all movies that we see. If we don't see that in a movie, it's amazing. And I've had a few movies recently where that has not been the message
and I just about fell out of my seat.
Well, maybe we're seeing a bit of a change. I mean, there are TV shows featuring singles like Seinfeld or Sex and the City or even The Big Bang. So perhaps, you know, society is slowly catching up to this idea.
It is. It definitely is. There's some new data out showing that 20% of women that have reached the end of childbearing, which is around 45, 46, are not mothers. And that came out of the UK, those numbers. But I think that's really exciting to think about the idea that maybe within another couple of generations, we might actually have as many people who say, you know, I don't think I want to have kids, as are saying they do want to have kids.
But, you know, even in the UK, and I was astounded when I read this in your book, The Experience of Columnist Polly Vernon, writing in the Observer newspaper just 2 years ago, this is pretty recent, and she dared to publish her decision not to have kids, and she got loads of hate mail. Are we free to talk about this publicly?
If you've been online in the last year Googling child-free or childless, you will see a lot of back-and-forth commentary on it on both sides. There's a lot of negativity. I know that you recently interviewed Lisa Hymas, and she's a great example. If any column she writes, which in my opinion is very neutral, she gets bashed and accused of, you know, trying to be a child hater, or it's almost like if you say anything about being okay with being child free, parents think that you hate them. You're criticizing their lifestyle.
Are people still feeling discrimination personally when they are child free?
Absolutely. The workplace is one great example of that. That if you don't have kids, you're often expected to pick up shifts on holidays or the weekends so that parents can be with their children. Parents get to leave work a lot more for soccer games or children being out sick. That's one area of huge discrimination.
And we have the inertia of government encouragement to have children. In Canada, women still get a monthly check called the baby bonus. And I was appalled to learn that in some U.S. states, people who are child-free but unemployed, they have no safety net. They can't even get welfare. How can we balance this out better?
I think that as the child-free population begins to form more of a solid group, you're going to see a lot more vocalization about this. We pay the largest percentage of income tax. And as you say, a lot of states you can't get health care if you don't have children, but the instant you get pregnant, you automatically do get health care and a monthly check. I think it's only a matter of time before we're going to be at a place where people are saying, no, why should you get a tax break for having children instead of paying more tax?
Yeah, I guess, because, you know, we've got to pay for the schools and all the costs of raising children socially. I wonder if part of the problem is our lack of time for cultural adjustment. Before the pill came along in 1960, there wasn't as much choice, and as a result, we have few positive myths or stories or cultural narratives about being child-free. What do you think?
I think you're right, yes. And it's culturally, it's something that we're trying to wrap our mind around. What are some positives about not having children? And I constantly am doing this with my girlfriends whose daughters are getting married, and they're already talking about how excited they are about being grandparents. And I'll say, well, what if she's not planning on having children? And these are girls who have master's degrees or PhDs and are clearly very focused and have invested many, many years in their schooling and their careers. To automatically assume that they're going to try to put being a mom on top of all of that, I think it's unfair.
I wonder, maybe this is programmed into our brains or our tribal history that we demand children, and really, is there a biological clock?
I think there is, and I think there's a biological drive to nurture, to caretake, to love, and that's one of the things I talk about a little bit in my book, that it's one thing to have that natural need, but to go a little bit beyond that primitive drive and to say, okay, I have this need. what are some various ways that I might meet it, including have a baby of my own, or become a first grade teacher, or get really close to my next door neighbor who has a couple of children so that I can spend a lot of time and be very involved in their lives. There's more than one way to meet a need.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Ellen L. Walker. We're talking about a growing minority in the developed world of people without kids. Ellen, we have Mother's Day and Father's Day, but I think Kara Swan's idea of World Child Free Day is a real winner. Are we ready to celebrate people who don't add more humans to the planet?
I say yes. I'm talking right now about how to get this organized. I think that this could be such an exciting thing to actually have a day where those of us who have chosen, or just simply by default, we have not added to the carbon footprint, for us to be thanked and recognized and given a little bit of appreciation for that.
Plus, you contribute a lot to society by working full careers without a break, really.
Right.
One thing I like about your book, Complete Without Kids, that it isn't a manifesto or a single-sided rant. You do lay out a lot of options, and you leave room for doubts. What are some of the things people facing this situation should think about?
One of the big things a person facing this situation needs to think about is the idea that it's normal to have doubt and to have grief, and to realize that by not becoming a parent, you are going to feel like an outsider a lot of times, and that you are going to have times when you have regrets about your decision, that those are normal feelings.
And women seem to bear the social and emotional load of this issue. What about the men?
Most of the men that I have talked to don't really seem to have any regrets. I don't think men have that pressure to become dads, whereas mothers, we so often hear that being a mother is the most important role that a woman takes on in her life, the central role.
Let's imagine two different listeners. One is 20-something, wondering or worrying about kids or not, and the other is 40 and child-free so far. Would you have different messages for each of them?
Well, yes, I would have different messages. The 40-year-old, it almost seems like she's at a place where she's probably not going to have kids if she hasn't by now. And she's probably needing to find a way to have peace and closure with her decision. So that would be what I would work with that woman on, is just really embracing where she is. The other woman, what I would be encouraging her to do is to really be examining this decision as she would any other decision, whether it's what do I want to major in college? Where do I want to live in the world? Do I want to live in the city or in the country? Am I straight or am I gay? Or, you know, just big decisions that people really grapple with and sometimes sit on the fence with. That having a baby is probably the biggest decision a person will ever make in their life. And to look at it in that way instead of just allowing time to pass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but your book makes clear the experience of being child-free is not fully resolved for some people. There are 80-year-olds who still have doubts or even regrets about the children they did have or the children that they didn't. So aren't we humans always kind of unfinished business?
I think we are. Yeah, most of us are. And I think that's okay. I myself have doubts about this at least once a month. I'll have the thought, oh my gosh, I wish I had a little girl to take care of. Or, you know, I feel sometimes sad that I'm not planning my daughter's wedding. And I know that I'm never going to plan my daughter's wedding. But then I have to think about the things that I've been able to do because I didn't become a mom that my friends who are mothers can't possibly ever do in their lives because they've spent 20 years parenting.
As we you know, head towards a wrap-up here, and we're looking at online resources. You mentioned NoKidding.net, which I noticed was founded in Vancouver. What is that about?
NoKidding.net is a bit of a radical group. It's a social group, but their focus is not that they're anti-children, but they'll come out and say they don't want to be around kids. These people are not the ones that want to adopt their niece's softball team, for example. That's not their reputation. But they're a social group for people who don't have children.
But not everybody feels that way. Do you have other resources for people thinking about being child-free?
I do, and a lot of those are now on my website, which I'm trying to keep updated all the time. So I would encourage people to look there at some links.
So that's CompleteWithoutKids.com.
Uh-huh, right.
All right, CompleteWithoutKids.com is a good place to go and find out more to follow up on this. Our guest is Dr. Ellen L. Walker, a clinical psychologist, out with her first book, Complete Without Kids, An Insider's Guide to Child-Free Living by Choice or by Chance. And I have to say, listeners, there aren't a lot of good books to help people decide about having kids or how to live child-free. And I think this one fills that gap well with some interesting case studies without any of the psychological, you know, academic kind of talk. I like this book, and I want to thank you, Ellen, for spending time with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
I'm Alex Smith.
Baby, you're the woman I love, and I love what it's doing to you. Having my baby, you're a woman in love, and I love what's going through you. The need inside you, I see it showing. Oh, the seed inside you, baby, do you feel it growing?
Hi there, you just heard two versions of the classic, Having My Baby, released by Paul Anka in 1974. The first one you heard is a recent cover by the cast of Glee. In 2006, a CNN poll voted it the number one worst song of all time. Do you feel the warm glow? We all have baby lust built into us, a yearning and a duty hardwired into our brains, and just like bacteria, we'll do it until we bust the world.
Food and fuel hoarding have led to shortages, which erupted into looting incidents throughout Asia and South America.
Speak out. Head to populationspeakout.org to find out more. Populationspeakout.org. And I've got a few other free audio downloads on the Population page of our Audio On Demand menu right on the main page of ecoshock.org. It's time for the Population Bomb. Let's talk with Paul Ehrlich. At age 78, he's smarter than I'll ever be, with stamina to fight on while others give up. When it comes to population, the name Paul Ehrlich inevitably comes up. In 1968, Dr. Ehrlich published The Population Bomb. About 40 years and 40 books later, this distinguished scientist comes to us with a new book called Humanity on a Tightrope. Dr. Ehrlich, it is an honor to welcome you to Radio EcoShock.
Great to be with you.
Well, first off, you have an authoritative co-author for this project. Can you tell us just a little bit about Robert E. Ornstein and how you two came to write this book?
Well, Bob and I have been friends for years, and he's a very distinguished psychologist, noted for some of his early work in split brains, for a number of great books explaining what we know about how the brain works. And we're both very, very concerned about human behavior in various dimensions, so we decided that it was time to write a second book together. We wrote one about 20 years ago called New World, New Mind, so this is in a sense a follow-up.
Listeners and readers may be surprised to find your new book is not really about population. Instead, you propose a common tool we'll need to face the many threats to civilization, things like climate change and polluted oceans and so on. So, Dr. Ehrlich, what is the common human ability that we need to develop?
Well, we already have one that allows us to put us in each other's shoes, and that's a very unusual trait for an animal, but we have it. And it's a critical one, and we do it automatically in small groups because, for most of our evolutionary history, we've been a small group animal. We lived for hundreds of thousands of years as Homo sapiens, and before that as other species, in groups of 50 to 150 people, where we could easily tell what was going on, often, what was going on in the minds of other individuals and, in a sense, feel what they were feeling. We actually have nerves that are designed in our brain to let us put ourselves in other people's shoes. And that's a really crucial thing, which we need to spread much further these days.
And part of your exploration is the positive and negative implications of our feelings for family. How should we rethink all that?
Well, first of all, human beings have come up with, particularly since the time of the agricultural revolution, with all different kinds of family structures, many of which work well, some of them don't work so well. I mean, the current myth that human beings are designed to be monogamous, one man doing the work, one woman raising the kids, and 2.4 kids who never think about drugs or sex, simply doesn't exist. It existed in the mind of some right-wingers for about 5 years after 1945, but we've found as a species all different kinds of family arrangements, and what we need to do now is design an overall family arrangement which lets us put ourselves in the shoes not of 100 or 150 other people, but something like 7 billion other people. We're a small group animal faced with the problem of figuring out how to live peacefully in gigantic groups and treat each other and our environments in ways that will allow our civilization to persist.
Well, if I'm being honest here, I'm not really convinced that feelings for distant humans will win out. I think of libertarians like Ron Paul. He wants to end foreign wars, but also foreign aid. And in its economic troubles, America may withdraw into isolationism again. So what are the signs that empathy is growing?
First of all, you got to look at what time course you're talking about. By the way, I'm talking to you about what will be required if we're to reach a sustainable society. Nowhere is it written that we will. Many civilizations in the past have collapsed, and we are now facing the first global collapse of a civilization. And I'm not sure where I would put my money anymore. I would tend to put it on we're not going to do the obvious things we should do to prevent it. On the other hand, if you look at the last few hundred years, for example, sorts of things we've done that cheer me up is we got rid of at least slavery in the United States, at least open slavery. When I was a kid in the 30s, if you were a woman, your choice of jobs, if you wanted one, was going to be a grammar school teacher, a nurse maybe, or a secretary, and that's it. Now, I'm an instrument-rated pilot, and I ended up taking my instrument training from a woman pilot. And today, many of your listeners probably have flown on airliners piloted by women. That's a change in the right direction. You know, it's World War II. Changed our view of what women could do, and also changed race relations. I was a Brooklyn Dodger fan in the 1940s, and when Jackie Robinson broke in 1948, there were big discussions about whether people with dark skin could actually play sports. And, of course, before that, in the 30s, lynchings were common. So we haven't gone far enough on gender equity or on racial equity, but we've come a very long way in just one short lifetime. So, you know, we have changed in the right direction in the past, just not far enough, and now we got to do it really fast.
You know, reading your book did bring some dark doubts to my mind. For example, I'm thinking of the many people in the land of cars and supermarkets that they think they're green or progressive, but they still somehow expect a billion or more people will die off, and they're confident it will be them, those other people on the other side of the planet, and not us here at home. But is that really how it could play out?
Personally, I don't think so. In other words, I don't think those people understand how tightly our fates are tied to people in the rest of the world and how much we've got to care, not just about them, but about our descendants. I have a great-granddaughter that I would like to see have a wonderful world. Think about it for a minute. There are 1.6 billion people utterly dependent on the ice and snow of the Himalayas and the Tibetan Plateau for their agricultural water. There are people who are already having problems with their food supply because the warming of the planet has cut the productivity of the grains, wheat and rice, that they are dependent upon. If the agricultural water dries up, you're going to have a horrendous situation there among people who are already well armed with nuclear weapons. And the most recent studies show that, for instance, if India and Pakistan get into it with a relatively small nuclear war, a few hundred Hiroshima-sized weapons, 15 kilotons, or firecrackers by today's standards, that would end the civilization in the United States and Europe. So, you know, things are not exactly charming, and we really have to do something about it.
And also, I guess if we let a few billion people starve away in slums, we also have a disease-breeding mechanism, and it only takes one day for the airplane to arrive with that disease here.
Absolutely. The rapid transit systems, a growing population, increases the chances of a nasty disease jumping from animals to human beings, like AIDS did recently, like all our infectious diseases did at one time or another. The disease situation is horrendous. The toxic situation is horrendous. In some subarctic villages, there are roughly 2 times as many girl babies born as boy babies, even though the normal sex ratio is 105 boys roughly to 100 girls. And that is a sign, going along with things like intersex alligators and frogs with 5 legs and so on, that show us that the hundreds of thousands of toxic chemicals that we've spread from pole to pole are not harmless and could very well turn out to be even more serious than climate disruption as far as our future options go.
And I'm surprised you de-emphasize population, though, in the book. It seems like your ship is coming in now. I'm thinking of the tensions in Egypt, double the population since 1980, 50% unemployment. Do you think the crisis you predicted in 1968 is really starting to boil now?
Oh, first of all, one of the complaints about the population bomb was that we said the battle to feed all of humanity is over. Well, that was 1968. There were 3.5 billion people. About 500 million were hungry. Now we've got 7 billion people, and about 1 billion of them are hungry. In other words, the prediction saying that, oh, we'll easily take care of 5 billion people, technology will do it, don't worry about it, simply haven't come true. And population is a huge element in it. The problem is, if we want to humanely deal with population, it's going to take us many decades, which means we should have started long ago. We should be starting right now. Our biggest tool at the moment, besides having to start on the population issue, because if we don't do that, we'll never get anywhere, is we've got to change our consumption patterns. And we've got to change the system of stealing from the poor and giving to the rich, which in the United States and the world as a whole has been so successful since Ronald Reagan instituted the program.
Well, just before we get back to your new book, I have one further question from a listener sent in, and he asks, Dr. Ehrlich, have you looked into how declining or more expensive fossil fuels will impact population?
Well, more expensive fossil fuels are already impacting population in the sense that they're increasing hunger in the world. The food riots trace in part to our attempts to keep the fossil fuel flows up, and by converting corn into the equivalent of a fossil fuel, that is, into ethanol. So there's no question our food system is incredibly dependent on fossil fuels, and we're not showing any sign of transitioning off of them, which means as the fossil fuels get more expensive, scarcer, and more importantly, as the climate system changes every more rapidly, it's going to clobber agriculture. You clobber agriculture where people get hungry and have nuclear weapons, and you can paint your own scenarios, and they're not going to be painted in sky blue happy colors.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Dr. Paul R. Ehrlich with his new book, Humanity on a Tightrope, Thoughts on Empathy, Family, and Big Changes for a Viable Future. Well, Dr. Ehrlich, I found the book really started to shine with some of the solutions you and Robert Ornstein suggest. Maybe we could start with your own stomping grounds, the university system. What changes do we need to make there to survive into a future?
Well, first of all, we need to teach people how the world works. I'm at the greatest university in the world. It's been a wonderful place, but I would guess that 90% of our graduates and 90% of our faculty couldn't give you a coherent story of where your food comes from. Or you ask the average American where their food comes from, the average educated American, and they'll say the supermarket. They have no idea, for example, but the huge connection between fossil fuel supplies and their food supply. They have no idea that the sort of cozy-sounding global warming may mean global getting rid of a lot of the food we need. And so the first thing we should do is start at the very bottom, of course, in our grade schools. In other words, we should get off of the See Spot Run reader and have one that says, see the plant grow in the sun, so that people would understand the connection between photosynthesis and their own lives. And go on right on up through closing what Ann and I call the culture gap, the fact that for the first time in human history now, the average person in our culture has less than a billionth of the information that's possessed by the culture as a whole, so that you have, for instance, a Congress full of people utterly clueless on how the world works. In other words, the people who claim to think that global change, that climate change, climate disruption is a hoax, just don't have a clue. It's very simple to teach someone how you know that the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are coming from burning fossil fuels. Nobody ever told them. And, of course, they're, besides being pig ignorant, a lot of them don't want to learn. And so we've got to really start educating through our school system, changing our university structures. We have to develop 21st century universities instead of 19th century ones. And that's a big order, too. There's a lot to do, and I can't tell you I'm thrilled by the prospects we're actually going to do it.
How could we translate your book to develop what I would call empathy activism? How do we make this work?
Well, I think one of the things that really goes for us is we're great social animals. We like getting together with other people, and we can get together with other people to solve problems. And a lot of people already do it. Look at the people who do charity work. Look at the people working in environmental organizations, NGOs, the Sierra Club, and so on, all trying to make a better world. That's the kind of thing we got the best chance of spreading, and it's got to come from the bottom up, and we're actually working very hard to organize the scholarly community to get the job done. We're bringing social scientists in to talk to natural scientists about how human behavior can be changed. We're getting people in the humanities involved, because we know just telling people the scientific results doesn't do it. You got to give it in the proper narratives. And we're trying to get the general public involved. Whether it'll work or not, who knows? But, of course, part of it is programs like yours and me raving on them to try and get people to thinking about these things and learning about them.
Yeah, this is really interesting. You know, you say in the book that we've passed the time where we need more physical science or more proof. What we really need is a rapid response team to figure out how to change human behavior. Could you tell us about the Millennial Assessment of Human Behavior, or MOB?
Well, the MOB is now an international group. It's really a network of people in the humanities, in the natural sciences, in the social sciences, and just interested people who have been talking together and working together about how to change the behavior of the people of the world, where we want to go, and how we can possibly get there. Because, again, the basic facts of the situation are now well known. Even the dumbest economist who writes for the Wall Street Journal knows that gasoline is underpriced in our country and should be much more expensive, so we cut driving the big cars and start phasing out fossil fuels and stop killing people in places like Iraq and Afghanistan to try and keep our flow of fossil fuels going. Everybody knows that. Try and politically to put a tax on gasoline and even start raising the prices towards what gasoline costs in Europe, and you'll be out of office. How do we change that behavior? And that's the discussion we're starting. And we've had some positive results, but it's still a baby at the moment.
But despite all the bad news, you and Robert also offer us page after page of hope. Why should we be hopeful?
Well, we should be hopeful because we can do it. It's not like, you know, the monster army from Mars is invading and they're 50 times as technologically talented as we are, and they're going to devour us. So, you know, there's a statement you're probably too young to remember. One of the greatest scientists of all time was named Pogo, and he came up with the straight answer. We have met the enemy, and he is us. And therefore, we have the capability of doing it. And in the past, we've seen very rapid turnarounds in attitudes. To just give you a relatively recent example, nobody I knew predicted that the Berlin Wall would come down and the Soviet Union would collapse as fast as it did, but it did. And our big hope is that we can change our behavior towards each other and towards our life support systems suddenly and rapidly so we can get the job done. And we know that given the right incentives, this sort of job, gigantic change, can be effected. In 1941, the U.S. produced almost 4 million passenger cars. And then December 7th came along, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and over the next 4 years, we switched to producing hundreds of thousands of tanks, hundreds of thousands of military trucks, over 300,000 military aircraft, dozens of aircraft carriers. We rationed meat, we rationed oil and gasoline, we rationed sugar, we designed and built nuclear weapons, we won the Second World War, and then that was only 4 years. And then the next year we turned it all around and went back to manufacturing automobiles and TV sets. In other words, when you have the right incentive, we could, for instance, do what Al Gore said we could do in much less than 10 years, and that is convert all electricity in the United States to not using fossil fuels. It would take a huge effort, a World War II style mobilization. That's what we need. we've got to recognize the enemy, and as I say, he is us.
Well, as we approach the close here, I wanted to ask you what research is interesting you the most these days.
Well, the research that's interesting me most is what we've been talking about. I've been working with several colleagues trying to figure out how culture, that is our non-genetic information, evolves. We have a pretty good picture, not complete and with some very interesting holes in it, of how our genetic evolution works. But we really don't understand our cultural evolution. The answer of, you know, why do you have Sarah Palin as a possible candidate for president? Seems absolutely insane. We don't understand why you get that kind of anomaly. We've got to learn how to understand that sort of thing and how to steer people in a direction that's going to be useful for their survival and that of their children.
One of the problems I've been working on that kind of is part of that is we have a movement now, the transition town movement or the relocalization movement. People are trying to make face-to-face groups that are under that 150 small group animal level that you discuss in your book. And yet we've got these global problems, and you're suggesting we need global empathy. Are they contradictory moves?
No, they aren't. It's got to be a combination because, first of all, we can be empathetic with more people. We actually can't avoid being empathetic to anybody we're exposed to. I mean, think about people. If you watch a television soap opera like Law and Order, if something happens to the hero, you feel bad. If you read a great novel and something happens to the hero, you can't help but feel bad. Our ancestors solved this same sort of problem when they put together 13 disparate colonies into a union where they tried to maintain individuality, smaller group functions, which they did quite effectively, and yet got together, all 13, to do things they couldn't do individually, like protect themselves from the British. And we face the same thing with nation states today. We can keep our individual groups and value them, but we can also value the larger groups and understand that what somebody does in Tibet affects our lives and vice versa, and that we've got to give up some of our sovereignty and develop some mechanisms for helping other people in the world because it's helping ourselves. If we do not stop the distribution of stuff from the poor to the rich and reverse it, if we don't start treating our environment right, we're all going to get out on the collapse. So we have to spread our empathy. It doesn't mean we lose our empathy for people that we know even more personally. We just spread it around.
You've been listening to Dr. Paul Ehrlich. He and co-author Robert Ornstein say we have an innate ability to understand and care about all humans. We need to redevelop that skill to survive in a troubled world, to understand how the book is humanity on a tightrope. Dr. Ehrlich, thank you for spending that time with us on Radio EcoShock.
My great pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith. You have heard it all. Check out populationspeakout.org. Download this program as a free MP3 from our website, ecoshock.org. And do something, damn it. I love you all. Thank you for listening. Next week, we'll join the people for a transition to a more sustainable world. We go out with music by Venice Beat with Tess Timothy.
In the year 2525, if man is still alive, can survive.